So today, let's take God out of the box and put a look at some of the miracles that the Almighty God performed on the journey of the Israelites. These were great signs and wonders, and sometimes we tend to read over the accounts in Exodus. But let's stop and consider some of the examples of God's might. Let's look at some of the lessons of these miracles, and they were miracles. Through these miracles, we'll see how awesome and powerful our God is. And perhaps the main lesson we can learn is that we must never minimize God. Going back to the book of Exodus, we'll begin our journey to look at some of the miracles and some of these great signs and wonders that God performed. We'll start with the crossing of the Red Sea. Now, bear in mind that the Israelites had already witnessed God's power through his deliverance of the Israelites from the 10 plagues that struck Egypt. Now, if you were to grade miracles on a scale of 1 to 10, 1 being the lowest and 10 being the highest, the crossing of the Red Sea would be right near the top, I'm sure. In fact, there were other miracles associated with the Red Sea crossing as well. And yet, as we'll see, there are those who fail to grasp the importance of those miracles. Plainly and simply, these were miracles, and not small ones at that. So let's look at the biblical account of the Red Sea crossing and put it into some modern terms. Hopefully it will help us understand the greatness of God. Let's turn to Exodus chapter 13, verses 17 and 18. Exodus 13, verses 17 to 18. Exodus chapter 13, verses 17 through 18. Exodus 13, verse 17, "Then it came to pass when Pharaoh had let the people go, that God did not lead them by way of the land of the Philistines, though that was near. For God said, lest perhaps the people change their minds when they see war and return to Egypt. And so God led the people around by way of the wilderness of the Red Sea. And the children of Israel went up in orderly ranks out of Egypt." The word orderly means just that. They went out together as a unit. That in itself was a miracle. The King James Version uses the word harnessed, which has a military connotation. Some translations use armed or ready for battle as the way that they went out. So let's put this into modern terms now. Now imagine about 2.5 million people or more. 2.5 million people gathering in one area in order to begin the journey in an orderly manner, as we just read in verse 18. Try to get 1,000 people or even 100 people to go in an orderly manner can be a challenge, let alone 2.5 million or more. The Israelites were scattered over the land of Goshen and had to gather themselves at Ramesses, which is their point of departure. For some, it was about a 30-kilometer or about a 20-mile journey, taking all day. So let's stop and consider that in modern terms. That 30-kilometer or roughly 20-mile journey to Ramesses, the gathering point, that was just the start. Now, if you walked at a normal pace of about 3 miles per hour, the journey would take about 6 hours, maybe a little bit more. Now, keep in mind that there were children as well, and elderly, and animals that took that journey. So the pace would be slowed considerably. So an all-day journey was not out of the question. And that was just to get to the starting point of their 40-year journey. Now, if we ended that 40-year journey today, it would have started January 30th, 1976. Some of us may not have been born at that time. So now we come to the crossing of the Red Sea. Now, just think of the logistics involved in crossing the Red Sea. If there were 2.5 million people marching 10 wide, the line would have been about 120 miles long, according to one scholar. Now, I did a quick check, and I found that the estimated population of Erie, Niagara, Orleans, Monroe, Genesee, Wyoming, Livingston, Steuben, Allegheny, Cattaraugus, and Chautauqua counties is about 2.4 million. So that's very close to what the estimates were of about 2.5 million Israelites. So all those counties, I think there were nine of them there, the population is estimated about 2.4 million, so very close. Now that 120-mile line, by the way, would start from Buffalo and go to Corning along the 400, the 380, and Interstate 86. It's estimated that it would take 8 or 9 days to march past any given point. Now, because the crossing of the Red Sea took place in a single night, the line would have needed to be hundreds wide or perhaps even thousands wide. Now, imagine having every one of those people gathered here in Buffalo and then begin the actual journey in an orderly manner. It shows the magnitude of the miracle that God performed just to get to the starting point of the 40-year journey. But it helps us to understand the magnitude of such an event. Notice in Exodus 14, verse 24, over a page or two. Exodus 14, verse 24. It is written, in the morning watch. That literally means the dawn or the break of day. So the Israelites did not have 8 or 9 days to cross the Red Sea. It was accomplished overnight. That means that they were marching more than 10 people wide. They were probably marching hundreds or even thousands wide. The gap in the water would have had to be enormous. It reminds me of a video I saw a number of years ago about the life of Moses. Now, granted, to pay 2.5 million extras for their part in this production probably would have been, exceeded the budget of the movie, but it showed the parting of the Red Sea to be just a few yards wide. And there may be a few hundred Israelites making the crossing and the gaps in between them as well, and maybe, two or three wide. So again, the impression is that God is minimized. We need to remember that nothing is too great for God. Now, some have discounted the crossing of the Red Sea by declaring or claiming that they crossed when the water level was low. The tide was out and they crossed on a sandbar. And when the Egyptians came across, the tide came in, sweeping them away. And we can use any human reasoning to get around the facts. Others have claimed that the original Hebrew term for Red Sea is translated as Yam Suf, meaning Sea of Reeds, R-E-E-D-S. Reeds being the plants like cattails and rushes and papyrus. And those people say that the Israelites simply walked across a swamp or a marsh or a land bridge. But the word for Suf can also mean seaweed. And in fact, there is a finger of the Red Sea called the Gulf of Aqaba that is referred to in 1 Kings 9, verse 26, and it is called Yam Suf. But these theories are meant to minimize God. The simple fact that the Red Sea crossing was a miracle. It was a miracle, plain and simple. And if there's a scale of miracles, this one would certainly rank near the top. Let's begin again in Exodus 14, verse 21. Exodus 14, verse 21. Then Moses stretched out his hand over the sea, and the Lord caused the sea to go back by a strong east wind all that night, and made the sea into dry land, and the waters were divided. Now here in western New York and in southern Ontario as well, we are in close proximity to the Great Lakes. And we might occasionally hear or read of a natural weather phenomenon called a seiche. S-E-I-C-H-E, a seiche. It's similar to a storm surge and occurs rather suddenly due to atmospheric conditions and wind speed. They are generally produced by fast-moving squall fronts. The seiche is from a French word meaning to sway back and forth, and that's basically what the water does. In basic terms, a seiche occurs on a closed body of water when a strong wind blows across the water, resulting in a lower water level at the downwind end of the lake and a higher water level at the opposite or upwind end. And since our prevailing winds are from west to east, most seiches on Lake Erie, for example, result in lower water levels at the western end of the lake toward Toledo in that area and higher levels here on the eastern end of the lake. And some of the seiches can be about 8 feet tall. Now imagine how much power is needed to part a body of water. In nature, it would be not possible. But with God it was possible. God divided the waters of the sea. There was a wall of water on both sides of the Israelites, as written in verse 22 of Exodus 14. So the children of Israel went into the midst of the sea on the dry ground, and the waters were a wall to them on their right hand and on their left. Now think about that for a moment. A wall of water on either side. That wall would have towered over them. Imagine being there. How much faith would you have to make that crossing? Now maybe the children, you know, children being children, they were touching the water maybe as they walked along. The adults might have been hurrying to get across, wondering how long this wall of water will last. But verse 25 of Exodus is also interesting. It shows another aspect of the power of God. Verse 25, and he took off or bound their chariot wheels so that they drove them with difficulty. And the Egyptians said, let us flee from the face of Israel, for the Lord God fights for them against the Egyptians. That phrase that he took off or bound their chariot wheels, kind of like driving a car with a parking brake on, or driving a car with only three wheels. I had a car years ago that had a seized front brake, and that car drove with difficulty. The wheel was, in effect, bound. It required a lot of effort to keep the car going straight. The car wanted to turn because of the drag created by the seized brake. Have you ever tried to push a bicycle with a brake on? It's rather difficult. It requires a lot of effort. Wheels are an amazing invention. Take them off a vehicle or apply the brakes and you realize how difficult it is to move a vehicle. It helps us understand why it was difficult to drive the chariots after God did what he did to them. Another thing to realize from this verse is that even the Egyptians knew that God was with the Israelites. He was on their side. Sometimes we wonder if the Israelites themselves realized that based on their attitudes and their actions at times. But by understanding these things, we can begin to see the greatness of God and the power of God. If God wanted the Israelites to cross the Red Sea easily, he would have had them cross in a shallow part of the sea or across a sandbar. He could have made it easy. Going back another step, why even make the journey at all for that matter? God could have made it easy for the Israelites by destroying the Egyptians in Egypt. But if he did that, what would the Israelites have learned about how great God is? They probably would not have learned that lesson. Because even with all the miracles that God performed, the Israelites still did not put their complete trust and faith in him. What about us? Do we fully appreciate God's power? As I mentioned, we tend to minimize God in our society. We just have to look at the educational system today, in our schools, in our legal system, for proof of that. The point is that God is great and nothing is impossible for him. The Red Sea crossing was just one example of that greatness. Just one of the many miracles he performed on the journey of the Israelites. Do we need absolute proof that the crossing actually took place? Well, there should be enough proof that it did. We need to have faith that God knows what he's doing and there's nothing too great for him. Even the parting of the Red Sea. The Israelites in verse 31 of Exodus 14 witnessed God's power firsthand. Exodus 14, verse 31 now. Then Israel saw the great work which the Lord had done in Egypt. And so the people feared the Lord and believed the Lord and his servant Moses. It's too bad the Israelites forgot that lesson from time to time. When things were going well for them, they displayed a great attitude. When things were not going so well, then they forgot the great power of God and they got angry and disappointed and lost their faith. The crossing of the Red Sea was but one of the miracles that God performed for the Israelites. One of the recurring miracles on the journey involved the pillar of cloud by day and the pillar of fire by night. The pillar of cloud provided relief during the day in the form of shade from the sun. It also provided a cooling effect from the heat of the sun. At night, the pillar of fire provided heat and light. They were forms of protection. And furthermore, these two pillars provided a reference point, something to lead them on their route. So going back a page or two to Exodus 13, verses 21 and 22, we can notice something else. Exodus 13, verses 21 and 22. Then the Lord went before them by day in a pillar of a cloud to lead the way, and by night in a pillar of fire to give them light, so as to go by day and night. He did not take away the pillar of the cloud by day or the pillar of fire by night from before the people. Notice verse 22 again. He did not take away the pillar of cloud by day or the pillar of fire by night from before the people. This was one example of God's protection, and it was a constant reminder. In Exodus 14, we see how these pillars were used against the Egyptians. Exodus 14, verses 19 to 20. So they were provided protection for the Israelites, but here God used the pillars against the Egyptians. And the angel of God, Exodus 14, verse 19, who went before the camp of Israel, moved and went behind them. And the pillar of the cloud went from before them and stood behind them. So it came between the camp of the Egyptians and the camp of Israel. Thus it was a cloud of darkness for the one, and it gave light by night to the other, so that the one did not come near the other all that night. So the Egyptians were literally in the dark, while the Israelites continued to have the benefits. And this is another example of God's mercy and protection on his people. It's too bad that the Israelites didn't always remember that at times. And more details of the cloud and the fire can be found in Numbers chapter 9, verses 15 through 23. You can refer to that, Numbers 9, verses 15 through 23. So after crossing the Red Sea and seeing God's power before their eyes, the Israelites were quite happy. They were ecstatic. Unfortunately, it was short-lived. They were in the wilderness for 3 short days when their attitude turned sour once again. There was no water for them. And through another miracle, God needed to teach a lesson to the Israelites. Exodus 15, verses 22 through 25. Exodus 15, verses 22 through 25. So Moses brought Israel from the Red Sea, and when they went out into the wilderness of Shur, Shur means a wall, and they went 3 days into the wilderness and found no water. Now when they came to Marah, they could not drink of the waters of Marah, for they were bitter. Therefore the name of it was called Marah. And the people murmured against Moses, saying, "What shall we drink?" And this became a very, very familiar refrain over the next 40 years. So he, Moses, cried out to the Lord, and the Lord showed him a tree. And when he cast it into the waters were made sweet. And there he made a statute and an ordinance for them, and there he tested them. So water was in constant demand, obviously, as it would be. There was always a need for it, especially in the climate and the region in which the Israelites journeyed. Don't forget that water wasn't only a necessity for the people, but the animals also required water. So we can survive a short time without water. Water serves as a way of keeping us hydrated, of washing away impurities from our bodies, and of cleansing or cleaning ourselves. And there were obviously limitations to the amount of water that could be taken on the journey, so there was a constant need for resupply. And God, of course, realized that. And the Israelites should have known that God would supply their needs, just as he had done up to that point. But rather than relying on God to take care of them, their reaction was to complain. And once again, God came through for the Israelites and performed another miracle, turning the bitter water into potable water for them and for their animals. And it was here that God made a promise. And through that promise, there was a test, another lesson to be learned. Verse 26. This is God continuing, and said, "If you will diligently heed the voice of the Lord your God and do what is right in his sight. Give ear to his commandments and keep his statutes. I will put none of the diseases on you which I have brought on the Egyptians. For I am the Lord, who heals you. So if the Israelites listened carefully to God and obeyed him, trusted him, if they did what was right in his sight, obeyed his commandments and his statutes, then God would deliver them from the sickness and the diseases that affected the Egyptians. He would be their healer. Around that time, the Egyptians had horrible sanitary practices. Their medical standards were about the same. And God had set out instructions to Israel throughout the first five books of the Bible, including those related to personal hygiene, to proper sanitation, to a clean water supply, proper diet, and controlling infectious diseases. Egypt was not abiding by any of those principles, and they were paying the price. But God promised that if his people obeyed him, he would take care of them and would be their healer. God wanted them to be healthy, and he wants the same for us. But in order for that to happen, we must live God's way, and that includes taking care of ourselves as best we can. If we don't live by sound principles, then we may suffer diseases as a result. If we don't live by sound principles of health, we may also suffer from diseases. And God wants us to live wisely. That was the lesson that God wanted the Israelites to learn. He provided that lesson through the miracle at Meroe. But it didn't take long for the Israelites to complain once again, as verse 2 of Exodus 16 points out. This sets the stage for another miracle to take place. Let's actually pick up the story in Exodus 16, verse 3. Exodus 16, verse 3. And the children of Israel went to them, that is Moses and Aaron, said to Moses and Aaron, "Oh, that we had died by the hand of the Lord in the land of Egypt, when we sat by the pots of meat, and when we ate bread to the full. For you have brought us out into this wilderness to kill this whole assembly with hunger." It's time for another reminder of how great and how powerful God is. It's also time for another test. And verse 4, "Then the Lord said to Moses, 'Behold, I will rain bread from heaven for you, and the people shall go out and gather a certain amount every day, that I may test them, whether they will walk in my law or not.'" And the test was given in verse 5. "And it shall be on the sixth day that they shall prepare what they bring in, and it shall be twice as much as they gather daily." So Moses and Aaron went on to tell the Israelites what they were to do. Verse 11 now. "And the Lord spoke to Moses, saying in verse 12, 'I have heard the murmurings of the children of Israel. Speak to them, saying, at twilight you shall eat meat, and in the morning you shall be filled with bread, and you shall know that I am the Lord your God.' So it was that quails came up at evening and covered the camp, and in the morning the dew lay all around the camp. And when the layer of dew had lifted there, on the surface of the wilderness was a small round substance as fine as frost on the ground. So when the children of Israel saw it, they said to one another, 'What is it?' For they did not know what it was. And Moses said to them, 'This is the bread which the Lord has given you to eat. This is the thing which the Lord commanded. Let every man gather of it according to each one's need, one omer for each person. According to the number of persons, let each man take for those who are in his tent.' And the children of Israel did so and gathered some more and some less." And verse 18, "So when they measured with omers, he who had gathered much had nothing over, and he who gathered little had no lack. Every man had gathered according to each one's need." So there's another aspect to this miracle. Not only did God provide for the Israelites, provide food for them, but he did it in such a way that everyone had enough. There was not too much, nor was there too little. The lesson here is that God will provide for their needs. And he does the same for us today. Notice something interesting in verse 19. Something happens here. "And Moses said, 'Let no one leave any of it till morning.' Verse 20, "Notwithstanding, they did not heed Moses, but some of them left it part of it till morning, and it bred worms and stank. And Moses was angry with them." So it was apparent that some still did not trust God. Rather than relying on him or in God to provide for them, they took it on themselves and tried to save some of it until the next day. And it became evident that that was a bad idea. Verse 21, so they gathered it every morning, every man according to his need. And when the sun became hot, it melted. Again, this should have been a sign to the Israelites that God would provide. Remember in verse 5 we read earlier that God told Moses to tell the Israelites that they were to gather twice as much on the sixth day. The sixth day, of course, was the preparation day for the Sabbath. Continuing on, verse 23. And he said to them, this is what the Lord has said. Tomorrow is a Sabbath rest, a holy Sabbath to the Lord. Bake what you will bake today, boil what you will boil, and lay up for yourselves all that remains to be kept until morning. And so they laid it up until morning, as Moses commanded, and it did not stink, nor were there any worms in it. Again, this was another miracle. Remember how it spoiled and stank if they tried to save any of it until the next day. In verse 25, and Moses said, eat that today, for today is a Sabbath to the Lord. Today you will not find it in the field. So Moses told the Israelites not to expect manna on the Sabbath. It simply won't be found in the field, as it was during the rest of the week. In verse 26, 6 days you shall gather it, but on the seventh day, which is the Sabbath, there will be none. This was a teaching moment for the Israelites. They were to gather what was needed for 2 days on the sixth day, since there would be nothing in the field on the Sabbath. And to emphasize the point, this was the second time that Moses told them. In verse 27, now it happened some of the people went out on the seventh day to gather, but they found none. Well, yeah, of course. And once again, there were those who did not learn the lessons being taught. They lacked the faith that God would provide for them, as he had shown earlier, over and over. And the Lord said to Moses, how long do you refuse to keep my commandments and my laws? See, for the Lord has given you the Sabbath, therefore he gives you on the sixth day bread for 2 days. Let every man remain in his place, and let no one go out of his place on the seventh day. And so the people rested on the Sabbath. So finally, after all that, the substance they were eating became known as manna, which means, what is it? They did not know what it was, and that's what they called it. But verse 31 describes it. And the house of Israel called its name manna. It was like white coriander seed, and the taste of it was like wafers with honey. That actually sounds pretty good. And as it turns out, this was a very versatile food. It could be boiled, it could be baked, it could be ground. This would be their staple until they entered the promised land. And God provided food for the Israelites for 40 years. They did not have to be concerned about where their next meal would be coming from or what they would eat. God would provide their needs. So let's keep our places here in Exodus and turn over to Hebrews 9, verse 4 to look at another aspect of the miracle of manna. So keep your places here in Exodus. And we'll go over to Hebrews 9, verse 4 briefly. Hebrews chapter 9, verse 4. Hebrews chapter 9, verse 4. Hebrews 9, verse 4. This is referring to the Ark of the Covenant, which had the golden altar of incense and the Ark of the Covenant overlaid on all sides with gold, in which were the golden pot that had the manna, and Aaron's rod that budded, and the tablets of the covenant. So the manna in the golden pot was miraculously preserved for centuries. And that ties in with Exodus 16, verse 33. Let's go back now to Exodus 16, verse 33 this time. And Moses said to Aaron, take a pot and put an omer of manna in it and lay it up before the Lord to be kept for your generations. So again, this was just another aspect of this miracle. The manna the Israelites ate did not last for more than a day, except on the Sabbath. And yet God provided some of it as a reminder for the Israelites. So like so many things in the Bible, there are physical and spiritual connections. The manna, the physical bread from heaven that fed the Israelites, was a type of Jesus Christ, the true spiritual bread from heaven. You can read that in John 6, verses 32 through 35. John 6, verses 32 through 35. This was yet another aspect to the miracle of the manna. The next miracle noted in Exodus begins in chapter 17, verse 1. By this point, it was quite apparent that it was not only Pharaoh way back in Egypt who was recalcitrant, but the Israelites were as well. But God set apart his people, and he was working with them directly. And at times it seemed like an uphill battle. Instead of being grateful to God for his protection, for his deliverance, and for providing for their needs, all they did was complain, it seems. They had seen God deliver them from the 10 plagues in Egypt. They had seen God take care of the Egyptians so they were no longer a threat to them. They had seen God provide protection through the pillar of cloud and the pillar of fire. They had seen God make bitter waters of marah sweet. They had seen God provide the manna to eat. The bottom line was that they should have realized that God would look after them. He provided for their needs up to this point. So why should it be any different from this point forward? Unfortunately, the Israelites lacked the faith that God would take care of them. This situation almost became violent in Exodus 17, verse 1. Then all the congregation of the children of Israel went out on their journey from the wilderness of Sin, according to the command of the Lord, and camped in Rephidim, meaning a place of rest. But there was, guess what? No water for the people to drink. This complaint was beginning to sound familiar. God could have easily made the Israelites carry a large supply of water with them, although that would have created its own hardship. Rather than remembering that God provided for them in the past, they should have had the faith to realize that God would provide for them here as well. Attitude played a large role. Instead of asking God to provide water, they complained. Verse 2. Therefore the people contended with Moses and said, "Give us water that we may drink." And Moses said to them, "Why do you contend with me? And why do you tempt the Lord?" And the people thirsted there for water. And the people murmured against Moses and said, "Why is it you brought us out of Egypt to kill us and our children and our livestock with thirst?" Notice a few things here. The Israelites contended with Moses. They complained against him as if he were the cause of their problems. It was also more than that, however. The situation was tense and was about to turn violent. It's a natural human tendency to lash out at someone or something that you can see. And Moses found himself in a very similar situation. The Israelites could see Moses, and he's the one they took out their anger on. But as he rightly pointed out, it was God that they were actually angry with. And rather than taking responsibility for their actions, instead of apologizing to God and to Moses, the Israelites became angry and somewhat irrational as well. Moses was desperate. He was frustrated. Completely understandable given the circumstances. In verse 4, he pleaded with God. He was about to be stoned. A mob mentality was taking over the Israelites. In verse 5, God provided yet another miracle as a witness to his great power. In verse 5, and the Lord said to Moses, "Go on before the people and take with you some of the elders of Israel. Also take in your hand your rod with which you struck the river and go. Behold, I will stand before you there on the rock at Horeb, and you shall strike the rock and the water will come out of it that the people may drink." So Moses did so in the sight of the elders of Israel. And he called the name of the place Massah, meaning tempted, and Meribah, meaning contention, because of the contention of the children of Israel, and because they tempted the Lord, saying, "Is the Lord among us or not?" It got to the point that the Israelites even questioned whether God was with them or not. They continued to minimize God. That was their attitude after everything that they had witnessed. How very sad. Well, let's not be like the Israelites. In spite of their attitudes, though, God remained merciful to them. Another miracle occurs in the victory with the Amalekites. While at Rephidim, the Amalekites attacked the Israelites. And Moses told Joshua to choose some men to fight against Amalek. Exodus 17, verse 9 is a key verse. Exodus 17, verse 9, then Moses said to Joshua, choose us some men and go out and fight with Amalek. Tomorrow I will stand on top of the hill with the rod of God in my hand. So this was the first time that Joshua is mentioned in the Bible. And Joshua would eventually succeed Moses. Notice that Moses stated he would go to the top of the hill with the rod of God in his hand. So Joshua followed Moses' instruction and fought against the Amalekites, who were a nomadic tribe, probably saw an opportunity of victory over the Israelites. A more detailed version of this confrontation is found in Deuteronomy 25, verse 17. Deuteronomy 25, verse 17, you can refer to that. The Amalekites attacked Israel from the rear, which was a despicable act. And because of that, God promised that they would no longer exist. And that prophecy was fulfilled in 1 Samuel 15, verse 18. Again, you can refer to that, 1 Samuel 15, verse 18. But notice what happens here in verse 11 of Exodus 17. And so it was when Moses held up his hand that Israel prevailed. And when he let down his hand, Amalek prevailed. But Moses' hand became heavy. So they took a stone and put it under him, and he sat on it. And Aaron and Hur supported his hands, one on one side and one on the other side. And his hands were steady until the going down of the sun. Israel was victorious. But again, it was not their own doing. It was not because of their actions alone. Moses held the rod of God in his hand. He needed to keep his hands up. But ultimately, it was God who provided the victory. And the lesson here is that we too need help. We need to rely on God to fight our battles. Humanly speaking, who knew that the Israelites would defeat the Amalekites simply by holding up Moses' hands? It just doesn't make any sense on a physical level. Yet this was another miracle that God used as an example to the Israelites and others. It was another example of the power of God. When the Israelites were camped out at Mount Sinai, they promised to obey God and to follow him in Exodus 19, verse 8. Seems the Israelites had short attention spans, however. Rather than remembering all that God had done for them, they needed to be reminded of God's great power. They continued to minimize God. Let's now move into the book of Numbers. Numbers chapter 11, the Israelites are complaining once again. Interestingly, it's just 3 days after leaving Sinai. Remember that they first started complaining on their journey that only took 3 days after they left, after the Red Sea crossing. But God became angry with them. God's patience with the Israelites was being tested. Their attitude or ingratitude was a source of frustration. So after God had set fire to the outskirts of the camps, once again the Israelites pleaded with Moses. Moses was the person that they could see. And he was in the line of fire, so to speak. And Moses prayed to God, and the fire was extinguished. And that example should have been enough to quell the complaints. Sadly, it did not. Ingratitude easily leads to rebellion, to attitudes that God does not want to see. He did not want to see that then, and he does not want to see it now. But in spite of the warning, the complaints increased. Numbers chapter 11, verse 4. Numbers chapter 11, verse 4. Numbers 11 and verse 4. Now the mixed multitude who were among them yielded to intense craving, so that the children of Israel also wept again and said, who shall give us meat to eat? We remember the fish with which we ate freely in Egypt, the cucumbers, the melons, the leeks, the onions, and the garlic. See, they forgot that thing called slavery. The question as who will give them meat was probably asked with an unsuitable, that is, might have been more of a demand rather than a question or request. Rather than saying to God, we know you have taken care of us in the past. We know that you'll take care of us in the future. We now ask you to provide our daily provisions, our daily need. You can almost sense the derision in what they were saying here. But now, verse 6, our whole being is dried up. There is nothing at all besides this manna before our eyes. And there it is. Let's blame our discontent on the manna. Let's not remember the awesome miracles that God performed. Let's not remember that God provided for our needs. Let's forget about the protection that God's given to us. Let's blame it on the manna. Got to the point that even Moses in verse 15 asked God to take his life. How incredibly sad to see how ungrateful the Israelites were for all that God had done for them. God does not give us burdens that we cannot bear. He will take care of us just as he looked after the Israelites. So here the Israelites asked for meat, and God provided meat. Well, think about this for a moment. If each person there on the journey had a quarter pound each, just one, it would have required about 375 tons of fresh meat. And Moses wondered where that meat would come from. Would they have to take their livestock? He wondered, he asked. If it was fish, they wondered, where would it all come from? And because perhaps Moses was frustrated with the attitude of the Israelites, his faith began to waver as well. But verse 23, God reminded Moses of something. Numbers 11, verse 23. And the Lord said to Moses, has the Lord's arm been shortened? Now you can see whether my word will befall you or not. Again, nothing is impossible for God. Even Moses had to be reminded of that. Verse 31 provides the answer as to where the meat would come from. There's another teaching moment here. Be careful what you ask for. Verse 31. Now a wind went out from the Lord, and it brought quail from the sea and left them fluttering near camp, about a day's journey on this side and about a day's journey on the other side, all around the camp, and about 2 cubits above the surface of the earth. So we discussed the cubit in the sermonette. So this would be approximately 3 feet or so, of about a yard. They were fluttering about the surface. That's a lot of quail. So God changed the direction of the wind so that the birds would fly into the camp of the Israelites. But he also provided enough quail for them to feed the camp for an entire month, as pointed out earlier in verse 20. So this was meant as punishment for the attitudes and the complaints of Israel. The reference to the 2 cubits above the surface has several possible explanations. And one of the most likely is that they were flying at that height, about a yard or so off the land surface, which will make it easier for them to catch. Verse 32 of Numbers 11. And the people stood up all that day and all night and all the next day, and they gathered the quail. There were so many of them, it took 2 days to catch them all. He that gathered least gathered 10 homers, and they spread them out for themselves all around the camp. So they had enough quail to satisfy their craving for meat. And verse 33, but while the meat was still between their teeth, before it was chewed, the wrath of the Lord was aroused against the people, and the Lord struck the people with a very great plague. So he called the name of that place Kibroth Hattaavah, meaning graves of lust, because there they buried the people who had yielded to craving. So the Israelites craved meat. They lusted after it. They weren't satisfied anymore with the manna that God had provided for them. They failed to appreciate that God looked after their needs. And they became ungrateful and discontent, and that was upsetting to God. Let's not fall into those same attitudes. The next miracle we'll look at involves the reconnaissance mission to Canaan, the promised land. We'll take a look at this from a slightly different point of view. Numbers 13 gives the details of who the spies were that were given the task. There were 12 spies, one from each tribe of Israel. Their mission was to see the lay of the land, see how many people inhabited it, whether they were strong or weak. They were to check out the cities and see how fortified they were. They were to check to see if the forests were there, and they had to check and see what kind of fruit the land produced. The timing of this mission was such that the first harvest of grapes was about to take place. So off they went, all 12 of them, to check out the land that they were about to inherit. And their mission was to last 40 days. Verses 21 and 22 of Numbers 13 give the route that they took. And verse 23, they found evidence of what the land produced. Verse 23, then they came to the valley of Eshol, which means bunch of grapes, and there cut down a branch of one cluster of grapes. They carried it between two of them on a pole. They also brought some of the pomegranates and figs. Now imagine a grape cluster that is so big that it takes two people to carry it. So it was evident that the land produced good fruit. God always said several times, or he's already said several times, that it was a land flowing with milk and honey. So things were looking good at that point. The 12 spies returned to Moses and Aaron with the report. They showed the fruit of the land. And they too reported that it was a land flowing with milk and honey, just as God said it was. The report started off on a positive note, but quickly turned negative. Let's pick it up in Numbers 13, verse 28. Numbers 13, verse 28. Nevertheless, the people who dwell in the land are strong. The cities are fortified or walled and very large. Moreover, we saw the descendants of Anak there. The Amalekites dwell in the land of the south, and the Hittites and the Jebusites and the Amorites dwell in the mountains, and the Canaanites dwell by the sea and along the coast of the Jordan. So at that point, Caleb stepped in, verse 30. And Caleb quieted the people before Moses and said, "Let us go up at once and take possession, for we are well able to overcome it." So most of the others still objected, however, saying that those who lived were stronger than they were, that the land devoured its inhabitants, and the men who lived there were like giants in their sight. It was one objection after another, one negative comment after another. They just dwelt on the negative. With two exceptions, the spies thought the spies could not see the positive aspects of the promised land. With two exceptions only. The rest of them lacked the faith and the vision. And once again, the Israelites, on hearing the report, began to complain. Then they wanted a new leader. They wanted someone to replace Moses and Aaron. And worse, they wanted to go back to Egypt. Really, when you think about it, it's incredible. But then Joshua and Caleb spoke out. These two men saw the same things that the other 10 spies did. All 12 saw the same things. Chapter 14, verse 7. They said, "The land we passed through to spy out is an exceedingly good land. If the Lord delights in us," notice that, "if the Lord delights in us, then he will bring us into this land and will give it to us, a land which flows with milk and honey. Only do not rebel against the Lord, nor fear the people of the land, for they are our bread. Their protection has departed from them, and the Lord is with us. Do not fear them." So Joshua and Caleb had the vision, the faith, and the trust that God would bring them into the promised land. They were seemingly the only ones with that attitude. They were far outnumbered. What was the reaction of the Israelites? Well, verse 10. Then all the congregation set to stone them with stones, Moses and Aaron, or Joshua and Caleb. And now the glory of the Lord appeared in the tabernacle of meeting before all the children of Israel. So God spared Joshua and Caleb from certain death. It's interesting to compare Joshua and Caleb to the two witnesses spoken of in Revelation 11, verse 3. Like Joshua and Caleb, they too will give a faithful report of the future promised land, the kingdom of God. And like the other 10 spies, there will be false witnesses, even as there are now. So it really is amazing to consider the attitudes of the 10 spies and the Israelites as well, after everything that they had seen God do for them. One of the lessons of the example of Joshua and Caleb is to keep the vision and the goal firmly in mind. They knew that God could take them into the promised land, as God himself had promised. All 12 spies saw the same things, but only two had the proper vision. Another miracle we'll look at involves Moses, once again, complaints and water. They're now in the final year of wandering, so the journey is almost over. They were camped at Kadesh, the same location the Israelites rebelled against entering the promised land. There was a new generation of Israelites on this journey. Sadly, they were as belligerent as their parents were. Numbers 20 gives a story, and it's a familiar one. Numbers chapter 20. Let's begin in verse 2. Numbers chapter 20, beginning in verse 2. Now there was no water for the congregation, so they gathered together against Moses and against Aaron. And the people contended with Moses and Aaron, saying, "If only we had died when our brethren died before the Lord. Why have you brought up the congregation of the Lord into this wilderness, that we and our cattle should die here? And why have you made us come up out of Egypt to bring us into this evil place? It is not a place of grain or figs or vines or pomegranates, nor is there any water to drink." Once again, the attitude of the Israelites was horrible. Rather than being grateful for God, for what God had done for them, rather than having the vision that Joshua and Caleb had, rather than having an appreciative attitude, they were angry once again. And after hearing the complaints, Moses and Aaron excused themselves from the Israelites and went to the tabernacle of meeting, where they fell down. The glory of God appeared to them, as verse 6 states. Not knowing how to handle this situation, they asked God what to do next, showing an attitude of humility. And in verse 8, God gave a set of instructions to Moses and Aaron. Take the rod and gather the assembly, you and your Aaron, your brother, and speak to the rock before the rise, and it shall give forth its water, and you shall bring forth to them water out of the rock. So you shall give the congregation and their animals drink. And Moses took the rod from before the Lord as he commanded him. So for Moses, following God's instructions so far, so good. Then something happened in verse 10. Moses and Aaron gathered the congregation together before the rock, and he said to them, "Hear now, you rebels, must we bring water for you out of the rock?" Didn't say God will give you the water. Instead, he asked, "Must we bring water for you out of this rock?" This was a sign of pride in Moses. And along with pride came anger. In verse 11, then Moses lifted up his hand and struck the rock twice with his rod, and the water came out abundantly, and the congregation and their animals drank. Now it's easy to read over this verse. Moses struck the rock twice and the water came out. Now earlier in the journey, Moses had been instructed to strike the rock, to take the rod and strike the rock so the Israelites would have water. But that was then, and this was now. Now he was instructed by God to take the rod and to speak to the rock. Perhaps in a fit of anger, and because he already had the rod in his hand, he ignored God's instruction by hitting the rock twice. This incident of pride and anger greatly displeased God. Now, was Moses justified by his anger? Perhaps, but it's still no excuse for disobedience. God saw Moses' actions as a lack of faith. Perhaps they did not believe God's warnings about following his instructions precisely. Perhaps they thought those warnings did not apply to them because of their positions and their closeness to God. After all, they were the leaders of the people. They allowed pride to take over. They should have realized that because of their positions, they were held more accountable for obedience. While they called the Israelites rebels, it was in fact they who rebelled. It is interesting to note that the water came out of the rock in spite of Moses' actions. The consequences of his actions, however, was revealed in verse 12. Numbers chapter 20, verse 12, then the Lord spoke to Moses and Aaron, "Because you did not believe me, to hallow me in the eyes of the children of Israel. Therefore, you shall not bring this congregation into the land which I have given them." Just imagine how they felt at that point. If only they could turn back the clock. As a result of these actions, neither one would enter the promised land. Aaron died a short time later after this incident, and Moses died after that. It was a costly lesson for Moses and Aaron. Pride and anger need to be controlled in us, and we must follow God's instructions. Failure to do so will result in us not entering the future promised land, the kingdom of God. The last miracle we'll look at today is mentioned in Deuteronomy 8, verse 4. And again, this too can easily be read over. Actually, let's begin in verse 2. Deuteronomy 8, verse 2. Over to the book of Deuteronomy. Deuteronomy chapter 8, and beginning in verse 2. Deuteronomy 8, verse 2 begins a summary of the journey of the Israelites. Deuteronomy 8, verse 2, "You shall remember that the Lord your God led you all the way these 40 years in the wilderness to humble you and to test you, to prove you, to know what was in your heart, whether you would keep his commandments or not. So he humbled you, allowed you in hunger, and fed you with manna, which you did not know, nor did your fathers know." Remember, the manna means, what is it? They had never seen it before. "That he might make you know that man shall not live by bread alone, but by every word that proceeds from the mouth of the Lord." So that summarizes the journey. God wanted to see if his children would follow and obey him. He allowed them to go through difficulties, but then he looked after them. He tested them to see how they would react. The bottom line is, they were alive because of the spiritual bread that comes from God through his word. Now notice verse 4 showing another miracle. "Your garments did not wear out on you, nor did your foot swell these 40 years." You know, they say things don't last as long as they used to. They don't make things like they used to. Don't you wish shoes lasted 40 years? Well, maybe not, but the point is that the clothes of the Israelites did not wear out during their 40-year journey. With all that they went through, the hot, dry sun and the cold nights, the rain and all the other weather that they experienced, nothing wore out. Again, it shows that nothing is impossible for God. God would provide the needs of his people. He would look after them, and he would take care of them. Those are things that we can take comfort in, even today. So today we looked at 10 of the many miracles that God performed for the Israelites on their 40-year journey. Let's review the lessons that we can learn and continue to practice. We looked at the miracle of the crossing of the Red Sea. Perhaps the greatest lesson is that nothing is impossible for God. We looked at the miracle of the pillar of cloud and the pillar of fire. We saw how God protected his people. We looked at the miracle of the water at Marah and the promise God made. He promised that if the Israelites obeyed him, none of the diseases that affected Egypt would affect them. We too must live our lives in obedience to God. We looked at the miracle of the manna. Just as God provided the needs of the Israelites, he will take care of our needs as well. We looked at the miracle of the water at Rephidim. The Israelites doubted whether God was with them in spite of all that he had done for them. We must never doubt that God is with us. We looked at the battle with the Amalekites. Moses could not have defeated the enemy on his own. He needed help, and we too need help to fight our battles, and God will give the victory. We looked at the miracle of the quails. The lesson is to be careful what we ask for. We need to appreciate what God has done for us. We need to be grateful for the blessings that God has given us. We looked at the miracle of the spies in the promised land. God delivered Joshua and Caleb from certain death. He can deliver us too. We must keep the vision of the future promised land firmly in mind. We looked at the miracle of the waters at Kadesh. Moses allowed pride and anger to fuel his emotions. The result of the outburst cost both himself and Aaron the opportunity to enter into the promised land. Let's not lose out ourselves because of pride and anger. Furthermore, we must listen to the instructions that God gives us. We looked at the miracle of the clothing lasting the entire 40-year journey. The lesson summarizes what we learned earlier. We must rely on God, not worry about the physical things in life. God will provide. We must always remember God's laws and to obey them. Let's never forget the underlying lesson in all these miracles that nothing is impossible for God. Let's never minimize the power of God. The story of the Texan who visited Niagara Falls and said to his friend he knows a plumber who can fix that leak in 10 minutes, well, that's nothing, because God can do it instantly.